In 155 BC, a man by the name of Carneades, Carneades was born about 214, 213 BC, lived to 129, 128. He was the head of Plato's Academy then, sort of the head of Plato's school in Athens. He came to Rome and gave a series of lectures there, which really sort of launched Greek philosophy, particularly Plato's philosophy, sort of on its course among the Roman elite. This, again, is exactly the kind of thing that Cato objected to. He didn't want these kinds of ideas circulating among his beloved Romans. Now, when Latin literary forms began to emerge, they were deeply influenced by the Greeks. So, for instance, when we even see Cato writing his origins, his history in Latin, and sort of putting virtue on parade, as I suggested a moment ago, this is not so much unlike the old Greek idea that history was the public deeds of great men. This is what we record. The ordinary details of life, the details of ordinary people, nah, that's not history to the Greeks. So we can see that Cato is in some way influenced by this, but then, mark well, he writes in Latin. He's not having any of that Greek for his son. We can see other Greek literary forms coming to Rome as well. For instance, comedy. Now, we might ask, what about drama? Well, it's a long time, actually, before Rome produces dramatists of any significant note. It's actually in the first century A.D., okay? There may have been some early Roman drama which survives today only in fragments or survives only by the names of the authors. So it probably wasn't very good and it wasn't remembered as very good. Though you'll perhaps recall when we talked about Greek drama, we saw that only a tiny portion of the once vast corpus of Greek dramatic writings survives to today. So we should be careful about generalizing. But what the Romans did pick up on was comedy. For example, the comedian Plautus, who's born in 254 BC and dies in 184, brought the Greek new comedy, the comedy of Menander, the comedy of the Hellenistic world, to Rome. And here we get all of these stock figures, misers, spendthrifts, braggers, parasites, courtesans, conniving slaves, all the kind of people who populate, for example, the plays of Menander, or as we saw, remember when we talked about Hellenistic comedy, the idea of what we might today almost call situation comedy. It's funny. There is no great moral lesson in it. You don't go away edified. You go away having been entertained. Now, as an example, for instance, we might take one of his plays, one of Plautus's plays, The Pot of Gold. There's a man named Euclio, and his grandfather has buried a pot of gold in the house, or he's hidden a pot of gold in the house somewhere. And has placed it under the protection of the deity that protects this Roman household. Every Roman household had deities that were thought particularly to protect it. Well, anyway, Euclio sort of knew this gold was there someplace, but he didn't know where it was. And he was a real miser. He's depicted as a real miser. So he's very keen to find this gold. Well, in the meantime, a couple of interesting things are going on. First of all, Euclio's daughter has struck up a wonderful relationship with the household deity, who has revealed to her, but to none else, where this gold is. Moreover, she has fallen in love with a young man named Lyconides, and in fact, she's become pregnant. And meanwhile, there's another fellow who is a very rich man, a very powerful man in the town, who wants to marry Euclio's daughter. Well, of course, you can imagine Euclio's position, this miser. He thinks that the young man Lyconides has only gotten his daughter pregnant so that he'll be able to get the pot of gold. He thinks the rich man has only interested in his daughter because he's rich and powerful. Already he wants more. He wants the pot of gold. So Euclio is always fending off all of these various people who are coming around to seek his daughter's hand in marriage. Meanwhile, a slave finds the pot of gold and steals it and runs away and hides it in some woods. Well, now, of course, Euclio has gone crazy. And he thinks Lyconides, the young man, has stolen it. And then he thinks maybe Megadorus, the rich man, has taken the money. And he's just beside himself and so on. Now, in a very comic scene, Lyconides comes in to talk to Euclio. And he says, well, you know, I have something to confess. Something's weighing very heavily on my mind. Well, Euclio, of course, thinks he's going to admit he stole the pot of gold and he's going to tell him where it is and bring it back. And Lyconides says, no, actually, I've made your daughter pregnant, but I love her and I want to marry her. Well, Euclio doesn't want to hear that. He wants to know where his gold is, you see. So, of course, the young man has no idea. He didn't steal the gold. So he leaves the house crestfallen because he thinks Euclio will have nothing to do with him. And then the slave comes up to him and says, you know, comes up to Lyconides and says, you know, I've actually stolen the gold and I've hidden it. and I'm worried I'm going to get in big trouble here. So he gives the gold. He reveals where the gold is to Lycaonides, and Lycaonides goes and gets the gold, and he comes back to the household. And first, he's not quite sure what to do. There's a moment where he's probably considering sort of just taking off with a pot of gold. But anyway, he brings it back to the house. Well, Euclid, of course, is beside himself with joy. And then now he decides that it'll be all right if Lycaonides marries his daughter. But presumably he's going to go hide. Well, actually, he does. He goes and hides the gold again. In a sense, we almost imagine starting the whole story. Megadorus, meanwhile, has discovered that the daughter is pregnant, so he no longer wants anything to do with her. So he's out of the picture.